Hey Elixir Mix fans, I'm Jamin Holmgren, co-founder of Infinite Red. I used to do a lot of Elixir back in the day, including building a content management system for Phoenix called Thesis. These days, we're a small but experienced team of 30 React Native consultants. We've been around since 2015 and have a lot of experience in React Native going all the way back to the beginning. If you're looking for expert help building, optimizing, deploying, and supporting a React Native app, I'd love to chat. Just go to infinite.red/elixirmix. And don't forget to mention that you heard about us through the Elixir Mix podcast so that we can keep sponsoring this show. Now, back to the episode.
Ready for a real relationship? Talkify is 6.5 times more efficient than dating apps. Why waste 40 plus hours swiping each month? Let Talkify's expert matchmakers manage it. On average, clients find someone special in just 3 matches compared to the 1,500 swipes for just one date on apps. With an over 80% success rate, confidential process with no public profiles, you can trust Talkify. Visit TAWKIFY.com to start your journey. Stop swiping, wishing, waiting. Start your journey and go to TAWKIFY.com.
Hey everyone, and welcome to another episode of Elixir Mix. Today on the panel, we have Alan Wyma.
Hello.
And we have a really special guest today in Bruce Tate. Hey, Bruce.
Hi everyone from Chattanooga, Tennessee. I don't get to say that on this podcast very often.
Yeah, it's great to have Bruce back. We've had Bruce a couple of times on this podcast, and he was one of the hosts of the podcast a few years ago. So, Bruce, your name will always be kind of tied to Elixir Mix in somewhere or another. But yeah, I guess like today we had Bruce to talk about a few different topics. Bruce has a new book coming out. We'll touch on that. But Bruce also mentioned before you started recording, and every time we have Bruce, we love to touch on the teaching aspect of things. Bruce does a lot of courses on Groxio, and there's also a volunteer mentorship / mentee session that happens once a week called Elixir Chat. I would love to actually talk about that first, if that's okay, Bruce.
I would love to.
Awesome. Well, why don't you tell our listeners what Elixir Chat's about? I'm a huge fan of that, and our listeners will understand why in a bit. But yeah, in your own words, what is Elixir Chat?
Yeah, Adi is just a little bit humble because he's one of our mentors, and he's been a tremendous influence in our attendees' lives. But this is a program to teach underrepresented people Elixir. And we don't try to lean really heavily into the underrepresented part. The idea is you can be underrepresented in technology and you get to define what that is when you join, or you get to bring someone who is. So we're not exclusive, but we do want the Elixir world to look a lot like the rest of the world. And we're about three things. The first thing is we believe that programmers learn to code by coding. The second thing is that we believe that making mistakes in front of other people. So if you're going to learn by coding, and if you're going to drive in a language you don't understand, making mistakes is a vulnerable thing. So the third thing is that you have to lead with love and respect. And so we spend more time getting to know each other than you would otherwise expect. So it's not unusual for us to shut down like the technical aspects of an Elixir Chat program and then talk about, you know, somebody that gets laid off or has a big interview coming up and kind of rally around them and support them. So that's what we're about. Coders learn to code by coding. Making mistakes is a vulnerable thing. So you have to lead with love.
Yeah, that's really amazing. And I think that really kind of sums up my experience being a mentor in Elixir Chat as well. There is like a different side of people that comes out when you build that comfort level, like focusing on like making sure we create like a comfortable / safe space for them to talk to things, knowing each other more. They're able to ask questions more openly. It's something that people look forward to every week. I've noticed that. Like, I haven't been to Elixir Chat in a few months because of my work schedule, but it's something I'm very eager to get back to as a mentor. And I know as mentees, there are others as well. I want to give like a quick short testimonial. My wife used to be one of the mentees in Elixir Chat, I think 2 or 3 years ago. And she still talks about like how much she learned from, like, she was there for like 6 months, like she was like half a year, but that 6 months of learning once a week, just over the course of years, that like really contributes to a significant part of how much she has learned. So just because of the variety of ideas that is there in that session. But yeah, it's really amazing. And I already know the answer to this a little bit, but I still want to touch on this, Bruce. Like, what inspired you to start Elixir Chat?
Yeah, so this is a little bit of a dark story, I think. I was at a programming conference somewhere else, and I'm not going to say where that is, and I'm not going to say which conference, but there were 403 attendees, and 400 of them were white males. And not that, gosh, I'm a white male, and I don't think that there's a problem with that, but it didn't look like the rest of the world. And that troubled me because this was supposed to be a headlights type conference, a conference that kind of set the tone for where programming was going. And if this was where programming was going, I had a little bit of a problem with it, but I didn't want to do a program that was hyper aggressive and political. So we came up with this thing of define underrepresented whatever way you want to, and either be underrepresented or bring someone who is. And when we did that, we found that when we engaged with people and when we engaged around their own projects and their own desires, and we just stayed with them and loved them until they were able to get some traction in the community, good things happened. So there are a couple of success stories. I just talked to Flora, who gave a talk at Codebeam Berlin. And Flora, if you're listening, hi. So Flora had a marketing career and came to an Elixir chat, and she had a newborn baby. And we had one of the things that we do is we put on a conference, and the conference is Gig City Elixir, and it's something that we put on in Chattanooga. It's really about this program. And if people don't understand that, the idea is to put some of the best programmers in the world, sit them at the same table as our mentees and start fires, right? See what happens. And so we invited her to come. We said, your ticket is free. And all you have to do is get here. We'll find a place for you to stay and everything. And we did. And she came and she brought the baby, and she was loved so hard through that whole experience. And she met her eventual employer, HCA, and Brian Hunter and that fabulous team hired her. And that relationship is an absolutely fantastic one. She's giving conference talks. She's growing in ways that nobody expected. And she's reading documentation and reading code and finding bugs in code just from being in the code base, right?
That's awesome.
Just a year and a half into doing this. And it's really a fabulous thing. And that's kind of what we do. It's not a rapid progress, but it's an effective way to kind of share connections and experience with the people in our community. And it's showing up on the stages and the conferences. That's nothing could be more exciting to me.
The Elixir chat, I tried doing some Google searching and I couldn't find any information about it. Am I spelling it wrong?
Yeah, it's kind of stealth. Yeah. So it's normally invitation only. We're casting a water net today.
Okay. I know where I'm not wanted, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit delicate, right? Because if you have to have enough mentors to love the people that come. And if you don't, then the people notice. And, so there's a balance, right? So, but if you want to join, you can reach out to Groxio Learning on X, or you could send an email to info@grox.io or to maggie@grox.io, and she'll get you added to the program.
Yeah, highly, highly recommended. I think one of the best parts about joining that group on a weekly basis, I joined as a mentor directly, but I think I learn, obviously, when you teach, you learn yourself. That's the thing as well. But I think one of the things I realized specifically from Bruce and some of the other mentors there who had more experience, like how to go about mentoring people who are newer to coding as a whole. And it helped me at my work too as a senior and a staff engineer to mentor others. Like there is a specific way to approach how to teach someone coding. And obviously like taking that empathetic as Bruce says, love approach, like making them feel comfortable and first before teaching them something. Seeing the effects of that really changed the way I approach mentorship at work as well. So yeah, highly recommend it for anyone who's in that underrepresented category, obviously, to reach out to Groxio. Yeah, it's a great group.
Yeah.
I was going to just like very not smoothly switch our topics to just Grokcio as a whole. Yeah, so I guess speaking of Grokcio, I'm sure everyone has some idea what Grokcio is. It's a learning website. How would you pitch Grokcio as a whole? What is Grokcio about? Maybe some of your most popular courses on Grokcio?
Yeah, so we do three different things. The first is that we do trainings. Right now, our public trainings are sold out for a bit, but we are taking slots for commercial slots. So if you have a team that you'd like to train, we'd love to talk to you. We also do video courses, and the video courses are on a wide variety of topics. Our most popular three are Phoenix LiveView. And of course, we'll be updating the courses shortly when LiveView 1.0 comes out. There's the OTP course, and there's also an Elixir course. And there's a new emphasis on Grokcio with a live book platform. And we have some projects that kind of walk you through projects there. And so what's interesting is that we have a Black Friday sale. We have one massive sale that happens every year, and it is a 40% off sale. And so that's a site subscription, 40% off. And that's all the way through the last day of October. And that'll be passed by the time we publish here, but all the way through November. So if you hear this, we don't do this often, but you get your 40% off at Grokcio just by hanging out and coming.
Yep, another one of the things highly recommended. I have the yearly subscription.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Sherry Harris, owner of LifeSource Water. Has your water been letting you down? Does the water from your tap taste, well, lousy? Is your skin and hair looking dull and lifeless? With a LifeSource whole house system, we help your water reach its full potential. Clean, tasty, and ready to pamper you from head to toe. So let your water shine. For factory direct pricing, call 1-800-WATER-99 or visit LifeSourceWater.com. LifeSource, taste and feel the difference.
Warranty limitations apply.
Through one of the hackathons prices, and it's been on my list to check out the NERVS course. I see that some of them were updated a little bit ago too. So that's pretty cool. Yeah, I'm seeing some live book courses, like you mentioned. It's quite exciting to see that being used on your website. What are some of your most popular courses? I see the Elixir one, OTP, LiveView. There's other languages too, right? There's Pony, Prolog. What are the courses that people usually tend to just like go for usually?
Yeah, that's kind of a little bit of an embarrassing question. So this was intended to be a 7 languages in 7 weeks. So the idea was that this was going to be a programming passport for the world, right? Learn to code and then hopefully bring people back through Elixir by exposure to other languages. And Adi, it was just too much, right? So learning a language a month, I couldn't keep up the pace and it about wrecked me trying. So we boiled the content down to just mostly the Elixir. The Prolog stuff is probably still pretty good, but all those other courses are free and they're not really full courses. They're just like four videos and then a mini book. The idea is that different learning methods are, you open learning channels by different learning methods. But yeah, mostly we're an Elixir site.
Got it.
So when Paulo, I don't know if everybody knows, but I guess people know by now, but Paulo Valim, who is Jose's brother, is working with us. And I don't know if people know this though. He came from a YouTube channel where he taught chemistry in Brazil. And take a guess. I want to get a guess from both of you, Adi and Alan. How many views his channel has had in Brazil?
I think I remember you mentioning it sometime. Yeah. And I think it might be last time you came here. I would say half, not so much, maybe 100 million. Because it did look 60, like
60 million. Yes. 60 million views in Brazil. Very good. Yeah. Great memory. But anyway, we brought Paulo on because he really has a good understanding of how to organize learning and learning content. And so since he came on, we've kind of taken this haphazard 4 videos and a micro book, and we kind of took that down to like a focused agenda with objectives, and we kind of blew out a full course for the Elixir LiveView and OTP. And we're kind of pushing that into the other Elixir topics as well. But the OTP, I think, is the big one that we're kind of famous for, both the Elixir and OTP.
That's really awesome.
I'm still kind of curious about, sorry to kind of sidetrack, but about the Live View book, because that's been in writing for quite some time. I understand why, because it's been, did I say something very sensitive, it sounds like?
No, it's just that it's that... So it is we knew it was a big undertaking when we took it on, and it has been a massive undertaking, right? We've rewritten the book about 6 times, right?
Yeah. And it's also because they changed the APIs and everything, right? And I almost feel like maybe they did it just to play with you, because it was pretty stable for quite some time, right? And then all of a sudden,
right.
And I noticed
Our timing has not been good, right? So anyway, there's a beta out now that covers LiveView. But what's happening with LiveView now is that we're going to the new generated code is going to I believe remove core components. Is that the way it works? I think that's right. So if you go into the main branch of Phoenix, you don't see these modals and these other components like that. It's going to, the generators are going to work a little bit differently. And that obviously isn't going to change most applications very much, right? Because you generate one time and then you're good. It's going to hit us really, really hard because, you know, we lean on like walking through this generated code and showing this as idiomatic LiveView, right? So yeah, but once LiveView 1.0 is released, we'll take a final rewrite. It'll go pretty quickly because we have the system down. And let me give a shout out to the Phoenix team. So all of these rewrites mean that the team has been working incredibly hard for the people in the community. And we were really lucky that there are so many professionals that'll dedicate so much of their careers to supporting this kind of new model of building, well, I say new model, but a communal model of building software. So I believe that open source software is like one of these last bastions of hope, right? Where people work together for a common good. And so a shout out to the Phoenix team. Also a shout out to Sophie De Benedetto. I had started taking on this project myself, and I could not have done this myself. I could not have asked for a better writing partner, somebody that's more intelligent, someone who's more gifted. And in fact, she did such a good job with this. As I moved out of my editorial role for the Pragmatic Bookshelf, she was the one that I handpicked to fill that role.
I haven't checked the recent edits to the book yet. I started trying to look into it, but I haven't gone back to it. But now it seems like we have like basically a divergence. You have 0.20 and then you have 1.0RC. Is your book doing 1.0, I'm guessing? Because, and also there's some differences, but not like major, but at the same time, there is some differences that do.
Yes.
Them. Yeah, it's kind of
the 1.0. The 1.0RC is there's going to be one more major divergence after that we haven't picked up on yet. And that hasn't been written yet. So
kind of also some breaking news and stuff that just came to my mind right now. Did you see the recent news that the Sorrent, I don't remember his name now, this is real name, but I think he comes online as Sorrent 2, and then that they believe is
Parker.
Sorrent 1. Yeah, Parker. Exactly. Yeah, Parker. He just announced that he's doing open web. Open source now? Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I would be interested to see if you can take a look. Whenever, I don't know when it's going to be released. It was kind of talked about on, I think it was Elixir Mentor YouTuber podcast, video podcast. They mentioned it, and a lot of people were saying, oh, it's a really, really great LiveView implementation. So I'm kind of curious if you're going to hold off on the book and say, take a look at that and see, could be some more interesting patterns or something that'd be nice to have in the book. Now that you know about it, do you think you're going to write that before? Because you didn't know about it before, right?
I don't know. So, I don't know. I'll have to take a look. Yeah. No commitment, sir.
Yeah. I'm also kind of curious to see how he implemented it, because I remember when it first came out, I got to like kind of beta trial it, and I was pretty impressed with how everything kind of flowed. The stuff you can do with LiveView is really amazing for everything. And CSS, how far that's advanced since, I mean, we're all older programmers. You know, I showed somebody, you know, how you turn an integer into a string with plus empty string. And they were like, how weird is that? I said, that was JavaScript back then. What are you talking about?
Right.
There's something to do with CSS now. It's like, I barely ever really need to write JavaScript, and it's been wonderful.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And I mean, that's been one of the evolutions that the Phoenix team. So when you park so much infrastructure on top of the web, which moves quickly anyway, and then you're sitting on top of an emerging language like Elixir, it's a pretty exciting thing, but it can be pretty demanding for a team also. And one of the things I wanted to talk about today was this idea that Elixir is a language that you can't put a box around, right? It's like when I started working with Elixir, I could point to two main gaping holes in it, right? And I could say with certainty that those holes would never be filled, right? The first one was this whole idea of immutability, but particularly how it relates to machine learning and machine learning models, right? And yep. Jose kind of said, well, what if I swapped out the compiler and swapped in this other piece? And, you know, we did just in time. And they kind of wrapped this with the extensions of the language, the protocols. And so I said, well, yeah, you could do that. And he did that and was stunningly successful. And the other thing was to go from a strictly dynamically typed language to something that is gradually typed now. And I thought, how do you do that? And I wonder if what we're seeing with the Elixir type system, I wonder where types are going to go, right? Because there's this tension between what can you express with the type system and what do you have to express with the type system, right? One is kind of how do you make developers more productive? And one is how do you enable the computer to make sure that these solutions are right?
Right.
So my head is exploding.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Like the correctness versus productivity. Like they're at odds for sure. I think Elixir is a good, like you kind of like alluded to, it's a good middle ground right now where it's going. Maybe it's going more towards a bit more on the correctness side, but yeah, it's competing priorities for sure.
So there's another element of this that I think is interesting. And it's so I don't think that you could give any leeway at all in terms of the type system if you didn't have OTP underneath you, right? So I talk about this conversation a lot that I overheard between Joe Armstrong and a man named David Turner, who was the creator of a language called Miranda. That was one of the first lazy languages. And so David Turner, so at this party, and I think it was Codebeam in London, he said a word, Joe, and then Joe kind of walked over to him. And he said, I didn't think that you would be able to achieve the reliability that...
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
Lowe's knows you want to get even more value for the holiday. That's why as a MyLowe's Rewards member, you get new member deals on holiday decor, tools, and more. And you earn points when you shop. More points equal more rewards to help you save on holiday and more. Not a member? Join for free today at Lowe's.com/MyLowe's Rewards. Because Lowe's knows deals. Program subject to terms and conditions. Points are awarded on eligible purchases. See Lowe's.com/terms for full details. Subject to change.
You did. With a dynamic type system in Erlang, right? And it really is pretty stunning that this whole idea of all this math on one side and lambda calculus and this tomes and tomes of math, making sure that things are correct, And then on the other side, this idea of, did you try turning it off and on again, dude? Right? But that's effectively what we had. But that system does work. The idea that you can reset to a known good starting state is extraordinarily powerful. And maybe when you pair that with a type system that is gradual, but is enough, but enables the programmer, maybe that is a stunningly powerful combination. That's the way that we want to build business applications. I wouldn't bet against it.
I also want to kind of lean into here. So I've been hosting a monthly Erlang Elixir focused meetup, and it's Asia based. And I've been lucky enough because of this podcast. And I also went to Codebeam Berlin and I got to meet a lot of people. So I've just been saying, hey, do you mind to come present? Somebody who I got to present in the very beginning was Robert, one of the creators of Erlang. And he gave a really great presentation. And then at the end, there's a Q&A section. And I think I was the one who asked, hey, you know, why is it that Erlang didn't have, you know, a strong type system? And he said, yeah, because actually in the presentation, he actually said, people said we couldn't do it, but actually we could. We just didn't want to do it. And he kind of like said something like that and kind of skipped over it. So then at the end, like I said, I asked him, hey, could you expand that some more? He said, well, basically, when you do hot code reload, which we needed, things got a little bit weird with strong types. That's why we decided to remove it. And okay, makes sense. So now with this gradual typing system, I'm curious what will happen now, right? Will we have issues?
Right. You know? I think that probably not. I think that probably what you'll see is that the gradual typing system will take it as far as it can. It will basically push the type system as far as the math will go, right? And no further. And so that might take us out some of these like highly theoretical, like the monadic thing. And I think it's really more than just type systems, right? It's the idea that we in the computer science field are kind of married to this idea of functional programming. And there are very few fully functional languages, right? And I think that maybe we need to get away from that. And in fact, if you look at the Erlang and Elixir ecosystem, if you look at There's a state machine that you can build into a process, right? That a gen server can be implemented as a state machine, right? And it's the message passing that gives you the installation, the message passing to this stateful entity that gives you the protection and your own design that's around that, right? So I said that kind of poorly, right? So I guess what I mean to say is that functional programming and mutability are all just kind of, they're shades of gray in there. And there are some pretty hard and aggressive collisions between programmer productivity and correctness. And the secret to building a good language is making the right compromises in the right places. And we need to be less concerned about shoving all of the guarantees up to 11, which also shoves all the math and the complexity up to 11, and more concerned about programmer productivity in catching the correctness in the right places, right? Like marrying a type system that's gradually typed with, did you try turning it off and on again? Heresy? What do you think, Adi?
No, makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. I think that's like a big, productivity is a big reason why people push back against Haskell, for example, right? I mean, Haskell is a very extreme example. But you do need some sort of correctness. And I think there is an 80-20 over here where, you know, you could get 80% of the correctness benefits with like only 20% or very little drop in productivity. I think that's totally makes sense. Honestly, I haven't experienced or thought much about the direction of the gradual typing yet. So this is the first time I'm getting to think about it. So I'm being a little slow to respond. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. That's okay. And I think that one of the things that you're seeing is an intentional slowness and carefulness in Jose's approach to the problem. And that's really marvelous. Really marvelous. I mean, I've said this before, but a great blues player is great because of the rapid notes that they can play, but also the notes that they don't play, right? And Jose has this beautiful balance, and he has this beautiful way of sitting out. I mean, he's not afraid to throw away a bad approach to a problem, right? He's not afraid to step back from an experiment that doesn't work. I mean, this is what, the second or third attempt that we've heard at typing, and this one it looks like is going to stick, right? I think it's cool. And yeah, I think that by being careful, he's going to allow more of his customers to come along and to adopt it and to, you know, see the benefits. I mean, everybody has been protected by now if you've been using the modern Elixir by the type system. I've seen three or four errors that were really, really doozies that the type system caught. I said, whoa, how did it do that?
Yeah, I kind of want to give an example. Like a couple of years ago, this is like a similar way of thinking, I would say, and Bruce, correct me if I'm wrong. Like I was working on building this application for a startup, and one of the parts of their problems was like a kind of like a bin packing problem. And I might have mentioned it on the podcast a couple of times, like more like a NP hard problem, not deterministic, for which like type system would be great to like capture a lot of use cases through type at compile time. And that's where like I chose to use Gleam, because easily executable through Elixir as like a binary or like module, right? However you choose to do that, and let it compile and run that problem in Gleam, and rest of the Elixir can be Elixir. It didn't quite work 100%, because once Gleam is done, there was still a few use cases for us to cache, but they were limited, right? You don't necessarily need to cache them in compilation or build. You can write four extra test cases instead of, I don't know, 100 for that the type has been attached for you. I don't know if this is like a similar kind of, is it in a similar vein? Because like I think gradual typing allows you to type like a, from what I've seen, like only a part of your code, right? Like just add that dot thing on part of the code. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the whole idea is that the system will infer what it can from the types, the type clues that you provide and the heuristics of the system. And it'll just do the work.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really fantastic. And I think that's really going to be what you're going to see with with Gleam and Elixir. It's the approach is, how much can I express and how much do I have to express?
Yep.
And there are massive sections of a system that we shouldn't have to think about typing, and we'll be more productive if we don't.
So I do have a concern, right? Because I think also Erlang is working on another type system. And then, of course, we have Gleam, but Gleam, I'm aware they do things differently. So I almost feel like, well, maybe we should kind of push more stuff to Erlang and then just downstream it, because I feel like, you know, things are going to be coming from Erlang. Why not start with that language? But maybe I'm thinking like, because they're not the same, right? So maybe that's not, it's not really required, but I feel like we're doing double the work. Can we somehow lean more into the compiler and more into the system and get more benefits rather than you do your thing and then I'm going to do this one and we're going to have three different typed languages and different, you know, can we do something more universal that you can
say? I don't want to talk out of turn because I don't really understand this system enough, but
I know they're working on it. Each of them have their own style. Can we do something upstream and then leverage the compiler so we can get a little bit more out of it? Can we? And I'm not saying we should, but can we is the question. Sorry, but go on.
Yeah, I don't know. But I do think that, you know, there are warning signs, right? We started to see a fragmenting of the Lisp community, and that's probably what eventually killed the Lisp language. So yeah, it's a concern. I don't know the answers.
Now I'm also, well, as long as we don't go down the TypeScript style where nobody knows the difference between, what is it, types in, is it like, I forgot, was there something I always had to look up? I haven't gotten a good clear answer. It's like you have type and then you have something else, and I've never figured out the difference between the two. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I don't. I'm not a TypeScript guy at all.
Yeah, I'm not a TypeScript person either. That's why I tried looking it up, and everybody has a different description, and I have no idea which one to use. Sorry?
I want interface.
Yes, that's what I think the one is, types and interface. So I'm like, I don't know which one to use. Like, I built this conversion. So I read in GraphQL file and I spit out TypeScript file. First, I spit out classes, which they didn't like that. Then they said, spit out types. And I spit out types and they said, okay, actually, there's a better way to spit out interface. I don't know the difference anymore. I know the difference between interface and in a class, but not types and interfaces. And this is a hot topic in the TypeScript community. And it's like monads. Everybody talks about it, but nobody can really clearly explain it to where everybody gets it.
Right. Yeah, I can't help you here.
I haven't used much of TypeScript. I think the interface is just the contract. You can have an interface without a type too, right? Like a type is, you want to start passing the object to the functions, which is what you want to use the objects for in TypeScript generally. But you could have an interface without a type from, remember, vaguely.
Yeah, that sounds alien to me because it is quite confusing. They're almost interchangeable to a certain extent. I know there's a difference, but anyways, I do hope that what Elixir and also Erlang and even Gleam, what we're doing is other people can also learn from it and expand on it and maybe make it better in other languages. Because
people are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply. Oh, oh,
oh, O'Reilly! You've got questions? O'Reilly Auto Parts has answers. Need a pro you can trust? We've got that too. No matter what you need, our professional parts people have the training and expertise to help you do things right. Deep automotive knowledge. Just one part that makes O'Reilly stand apart. The professional parts people. Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
I feel so. I used to do a lot of Rails, and I felt like they were kind of trendsetters. And then I moved to Elixir, and then now I feel like Elixir started trendsetting. Maybe it's whatever I'm doing. People start getting magic. I don't know, but because with like LiveView, then everybody started doing a bunch of LiveView like kind of things. And now we're working with types. Now I'm wondering if maybe Ruby or Python. Well, Python has something like it has some kind of typing system, but maybe Ruby will also start to have something too. I think.
Well, I think the Ruby is Crystal, right? So there's that Argentinian team that built the Crystal language, and it is gradually typed. Also, I believe it's pretty cool.
I think Sorbet is another thing, right? With Ruby that I know some teams use. So that's
I haven't followed that one.
Okay, I think that's a gem that you can add, which adds typing. I think that's not gradual, from what I remember. If you introduce it, it has a bleeding effect throughout the code.
Mm. Yeah, it's been a while since I've written Ruby in anger.
So what have you done in anger recently? That just came to my mind.
So mostly it's Elixir. We've been kind of focused on, we're doing a lot of mentoring style projects, and we have a customer here in Chattanooga that is a healthcare based customer that we're working with. And so we're doing some enrollment based code for them, and we're using a framework that I like a lot called Flop. And that's kind of a table, how to represent paginated tables with sorting and filtering. And it allows me to extend models through interfaces and protocols. And yeah, I like it quite a lot, actually.
Wait, you said Flop. You're talking about the library Flop?
Yeah, Flop and Flop Phoenix. Yep.
Yeah, I use Flop quite a lot. I quite like Flop. You can do a lot of really interesting things with it.
Yeah.
But
yeah, but in terms of languages, I haven't been eating my own dog food, right? Yeah. Last other programming language that I wrote was probably a little bit of Lua a couple of years ago.
Well, speaking of the programming language, there's another new book from Craig Prague there. I don't think you wrote that one also related to languages, but a similar tone as what you had before.
Yes, I was not involved with that one. It's the first 7-series book that I haven't been involved with, but it's fun to see that series come alive again. You know, that time was interesting because at that point, most books were focused on a very narrow problem, right? And very few books were about broad explorations of topics. And so 7 Languages in 7 Weeks caught Joe Armstrong's imagination because he wanted to trigger people's love of programming languages again. And that book was very much that for me. And when I wrote the first one, the Prague said, hey, this is a theme that could be pretty interesting. And this method of thinking about problem solving could be interesting across databases and concurrency models and things like that. So yes, the obscure languages, the 7 Obscure Languages in 7 Weeks came out recently. I don't know exactly when the publication date was, but I saw that and tracked it with a lot of interest.
Yeah, what you said about 7 Languages in 7 Weeks, I've talked enough about that book. It's amazing. I got that book because of the first language in it. It was Ruby, and I wanted to learn Ruby like quickly, like a book that can teach me Ruby quickly, because it was my first job and I had to do Ruby. I did not know Ruby. I read through it and it was like very smooth and like, oh, wow, I feel like I know a good amount of it. And that was like just one day. And I'm like, you know, let me take a week's break. And the next week I read through the entire book. It just was amazing. I think that the language that blew my mind was Prologue. Yes. It was like fourth or fifth. That just like kind of built a lot of momentum. I just couldn't stop after that. And then you finish with Haskell. It was amazing. Yeah. It did ignite that programming love, like you were saying, right? Like I have not heard you say that before, but it did. For me, it's like one of the inflection points for me. It's like increased my ability to code longer periods of time because I just like enjoy that so much, right? Like whenever I want to code longer, I kind of tap into that feeling and like, oh, I'm able to like extend my how long I can code. It's pretty awesome. But for anyone trying to like reignite your love for programming, I'd highly recommend that book.
Yeah, thank you so much. And so that book, there's a couple of key points in the evolution of that book that were really important. And one was Joe Armstrong took me under his wing when we sent him three chapters. We sent him Ruby, Prologue, and Erlang. He skipped Ruby. He didn't make any notes. And he read the Prologue and Erlang. So Erlang, I had based on his examples, right? I did the highly politically incorrect Russian roulette game. And, you know, and so I wrote that. And so Joe said, I get the sense that Bruce Tate understands Erlang very well, which was decidedly not true, right? And then he said, I don't get the same sense for Prologue. This chapter is a wreck. You can't publish this book, right? And so I swallowed my pride and I reached out to him and he kind of welcomed me with open arms and walked through and helped me write a better Prologue chapter. And I can remember being on a phone or a chat or something with Erlang or with Joe. And so I was saying, well, I don't know where to go with this program. He says, what are you writing? I said, I'm doing a Sudoku solver. And he said, well, what are you trying to do? And I said, well, I've established the rules of the game. And he said, did you try to run it? And I ran the program and it started spitting out answers. And then he started laughing and he said, that's your Prologue moment. Yeah. That is your Prologue moment. And that was a really cool. So that was very pivotal in the life of the book. And the other one was when Stu Halloway of who's a closure person, helped me think through, distill the example to give in Scala. Yeah, he gave a technical review of that book that was just absolutely excellent. And he helped me rethink what to do in Scala as well as what to do in closure. And I feel like with those contributions, I was able to adopt these new languages and not completely embarrass myself. And those people also gave me access to others in the industry where I could ask some questions and have some interviews about these languages. And it was really a cool moment, a career-defining moment for me.
That's really awesome.
So he skipped the Erlang part and went straight to Prologue. Okay.
That's right.
I understand there's definitely a lot of similarities. And I think the first Erlang compiler or VM or whatever you want to call it was all in Prologue. And the syntax is in Prologue.
Joe loves Prologue, or loved, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess he stopped loving it and started loving Erlang to a certain extent, but then it's so similar, I have my understanding, that not much changed necessarily, right? Maybe some better ideas, right?
Yeah. So he let go of the unification and started embracing the message passing, but kind of the pattern matching grew out of that. The syntax makes a whole lot more sense. So Erlang made a whole lot more sense after I wrote a little bit of Prologue. You know, I can remember going to one of the first EUCs, which is the Erlang user community in Sweden, in Stockholm. And so I was answering a question about something I said in seven languages. And so somebody said something about the Erlang syntax. And I said, well, I guess I said that I repeated what I said in the book, right? I said in this cafeteria where all the people, all this Erlang community is around me. I repeated this comment. So I guess Erlang has an unnatural syntax. And then halfway across the cafeteria, Joe Armstrong stood up and said, what do you mean? Erlang has a beautiful syntax. And then he had this expectant grin, like he wanted to kick off a debate. And so I just kind of, I turned bright red and just crumbled and caved in the moment. It was really, really funny.
It definitely has a, if you're not used to it, it's definitely an interesting syntax to say the least.
It's a different family of languages, right? We're used to languages that have come from, you know, the C or the Python line. And this is a language that has come down from the, you know, the prologue and then on up that tree that way.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, isn't something like use commas after each line or something, and then use a semicolon? I forget the rules. It's definitely, I heard like it follows English grammar sort of with the, I want to say punctuation, but it's, I don't know what
it does. It does. It's, your clauses are separated by commas, and there's a period at the end of everything. And so, you know, you always, that's the way that all of Erlang is punctuated. And when you get that, it's a lot simpler. But I didn't get that for a long, long time until I wrote a little prologue. Then I thought, oh!
In your book, I think you had prologue before Erlang, maybe for that reason. I had not experienced Erlang before that. So it clicked right away. But one of the hilarious things about prologue is I think it just shows a whole logic-oriented aspect of it. I think the statements are called facts, right? Like the facts, and then the what you're trying to solve, the question is called a query. It's just incredible that it doesn't feel like a programming language. It feels like almost like an AI, right? I mean, like it's more directly an AI than just like something you're coding. It just feels like something that'll solve something for you. It's pretty crazy. But yeah, you're right. The whole syntax of Erlang like matches quite similarly to Prolog. You can see the influence there. It's crazy.
It does. And if you want to try something interesting, there's a interesting marriage more of like a Prolog-like language where...
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.
You know, the hard part about Prolog is integrating with the rest of the world after you have these insights, right? And more of a traditional like multi-mode language. But there's a Lisp version of Prolog called Minicanron that we covered in 7 more languages in 7 weeks. And that's a really cool experimentation of what you can do when you can tie these concepts together. So for the listeners that are looking to break their brains beyond what you can do with Prolog, this is a great way to go.
Yeah, that's the one that I honestly couldn't. I think that was it the last chapter in your book, the 7 more? I vaguely remember it was. I think it was kind of going over my head a little bit.
Right. Yeah, that was a demanding chapter to write. I forgot who wrote that one. Was it Frank? Yeah, I don't remember.
I have a feeling like you tend to attract hard books. Is that what it is? You have recent ones, the live view one, and we were talking about this one was a toughie. And you almost kind of bring some controversy, right? When you make the comment and then Joe, you know, spoke up, or were you trying to have him speak up? Is that why you said what you said?
Oh, no. So I don't lean into controversy most of the times in my career. The few times I have, I've really put my foot in it. But I think in terms of difficult books, my best books have always been when I was afraid or searching and genuinely brought my readers along for the exploration. Because I think that during those times, I was searching for the same things that my readers were, right? Like 7 languages in 7 weeks wasn't really about learning 7 languages. It was about saying, oh, wait a minute, we're out of gas in this particular line of programming. Programming is going somewhere else. Where's it going? And so that was a journey. And the languages were chosen to specifically take us step by step in a journey towards functional programming from dynamically typed to strongly typed. And yeah, that's the way that they were presented. And that's how I actually did the research. And so some of the harder books, like Designing Elixir Systems with OTP, that was one that was written with James Gray. And he struggled with that book for a while before I got involved. And he had some immaculate research, But you know, you talk about a Lisp. James Gray is a human Lisp machine. He couldn't write a sentence without like 17 parentheticals because he knows everything about everything. And I taught James to lie a little bit, right? I taught him to lie a little bit and simplify and then go back and touch those things up, right? And so then you can build this framework. And then the other thing that I did is we came up with the phrase together, do fun things with big, loud worker bees that helped walk people through the layers of an Elixir system. And then once we had that, the book just kind of flowed and, you know, it went from a years long project and then we just kind of hammered it out quickly. But yeah, I like that. I like the challenge of writing about complex topics and distilling them down to something interesting. And the only reason that the LiveView book is hard is that the technology is fluid, and that is a good thing. That means that we have a wonderful team supporting this effort. And I'm just catching, you know, we made a conscious decision to be involved early in that process because it's very hard to write a book and a framework at the same time.
For the, actually, I do want to kind of go back to the design systems book.
Yeah.
Design Elixir systems. I have a couple of questions, right? But I'm just going to start with the first one and give you time to answer that one. Let me just say a little bit more. What I heard about Erlang when it kind of first started coming out and becoming more popular, I believe the talk was, oh, if you want to learn Erlang, you have to go work at an Erlang company because basically there's no material, there's no patterns kind of out there in the open, etc. Now, we have your book, and I think your book is a great example. In fact, after I started, I didn't finish it still, but I read enough to start to understand it. And what I have to say is now you've changed the way I program stuff, and I'm really happy with that pattern. It's made it more testable. I think with each book I pick up from Prague, Prague and Elixir, I'd start to change the way I write code differently. And it's been all positives, right? Maybe I don't adopt everything that's been given to me, but I adopt what I feel makes sense. And so what I wanted to say was, for your book, how did you learn how to design Elixir systems? I guess I could say, you know, where did you get your inspiration from? Was it just asking people? Were you reading code?
No, that's James. That's all James.
Oh, really?
So James, he's, so a little thing about him is he has MS. And so that means that he has very little of the function in his hands. And so he types very, very slowly and has like some dictation that he works with. And, but he's also one of the fastest programmers I've ever known, right? Because he's Mensa, very smart. He reads everything and he has to automate everything. And he's a wonderful human being with tremendous empathy. So he writes for the people reading his code. And you put all those things together and you get just this fountain of information. And so what he did was put together the research. What I did is help to distill the research into this layering system that was easy to understand. And so what I did is took all of James's immaculate research. We organized it. We found this framework, the Do Fun Things framework. And then after we found that, then we were able to compartmentalize that research and throw out the things that didn't fit, right? And so then you got this marvelous exploration of the data structures in Elixir, which shapes the way that I teach, shapes the way that I program. Then you had this marvelous exploration of what a function is and how you deal with errors in functions. And then you have this really cool treatment of tests where we build these tests that look like nice pipelines, right? And then, you know, layer upon layer upon layer, the collaboration built something that neither one of us could have built alone.
Well, my follow-up question, what's funny that you start mentioning James, is what is James doing? Because I kind of feel like he came in the community and he kind of, I don't know if I wouldn't even say left, it just kind of disappeared. Because I'd say you're definitely still out there, still doing things. A lot of people are still in the community or sometimes popping it up. But James seems that he helped with this book. Obviously, he's saying that he did a lot of the work on it. But then I don't really hear too much of him since then. Is he still involved with Elixir? Has he moved on? Or do you have
I'm going to plug one of my competitors here. So he has a... So if you Google Scrappy Programmer, James has a course, has a live book, Elixir course. It's really cool. And it's especially good for training new Elixir developers. And that's, yeah, I'm a big fan of his work. And I think there's room for what both of us do. But yeah. But in terms of why you don't see as much of him, he's a great dad. He's got a wonderful daughter named Summer and he's got a great family. And yeah, so kudos to you, James, for being a great dad, if you're listening.
Yeah, I did not know about Scrappy Programmer. That's very, very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can link the Elixir, there's an Elixir forum thread. We can link in the show notes for others to grab that.
Yeah, right under the Grazio 40% off coupon.
Of course.
No, yeah, I think that readers will be really, really happy to get both. You'll be glad you did, and it'll jumpstart your Elixir career.
Awesome. I guess I wanted to talk about another book now. I think this is like a bit of a different book you mentioned earlier, Bruce. Currently Away. It's been something you've been working on. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is one that's been out for a while. It's been out almost a year now. So in 2022, my wife and I were battling depression, you know, like a lot of us were in the Elixir community. And she came up with this idea of doing a COVID quarantine on a boat, encircling the Eastern United States. So this book is one from the Pragmatic Bookshelf. You know, Alan, you mentioned the Pragmatic Bookshelf and that it's a great resource for us. Well, it is. But one of the things that the whole technical publishing industry is facing is the competition with ChatGPT and all these other resources that are online, in combination with the amount of time that it takes to write a technical book. By the time that it's out, it has a very short shelf life, right? Well, one of the Prag's responses to that was to get some stories from people that are well known in the industry, like myself. And so we took this trip around the Eastern United States and told that story, right? And so the story is about, so any travel memoir is a story within a story. It's about 90,000 words, which works out to, you know, 300 to 400 pages. And it talks about the kind of underlying truths as we took on this trip, you know, amidst the COVID pandemic and the Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, that impact on fuel prices, and people were buying boats and, you know, sucking up all the space and marinas, and weather changing, and all these things were happening as we were doing this trip, and we were finding ourselves again. And so if people want to find that, you can go to the Pragmatic Bookshelf, or you can go to Amazon and just look for Currently Away. And we'd love to hear what you have to say about that book.
It's such a different book compared to what Pragmatic Program usually ships, right? So I was kind of curious about the discussions with that. Was that something that they, how do I say this? How was it pitched and how was the reception initially? Because usually there could be some changes in between, right?
Yeah. So the idea is that there is a need for publishers to have books with a long tail, with a long shelf life, right? And so the Pragmatic Bookshelf needs books like Currently Away and other stories that have some type of a technical interest. And in this case, the technical interest is a professional doing the job on the road or on the waterways, if you will. And there are some other stories about emerging technologies or security, but they cover more of the human side. And I think that it's a great way to support the bookshelf, and it's also a great way to kind of break away from, to take a small step away from your technical education regimen and kind of fold in something else, if you will, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. Just if somebody told me, oh, we have this kind of book and it's from Pragpa, I would say, that sounds more like I'm just going to throw Manning out there, because Manning does a lot of different books that are not only tech related in terms of like how to code something, but also how to do your career or how to do whatever, right? This was a prep pod. Yeah. When I think of prep pod, it's like more hands-on. You're going to learn a skill. They're going to take you on a journey. It's just such a different book in my mind.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think that's intentional. I think that expanding, casting the wider net is pretty important.
Now, has this triggered more potential other books in this series? So you're going to have this, I don't know, what is the term that you call this kind of book? Long tail or how would you
long
call it?
Long tail, yeah. So basically, this line is called Pragmatic Stories. And it's basically nonfiction with a technical bent. And so it's basically a story with the human side that might be of interest to the pragmatic community.
Nice. It's really cool. I actually, until you did this in 2022, Bruce, I didn't realize you could do a loop. I didn't realize you could do from one of the lakes all the way to the south of the continent. I did not realize that's a thing, but it's really cool.
Yeah. So, well, we came down the Mississippi for just a very short, we were just on there for 3 days. There's also this long canal called the Tin Tom Waterway that goes between Alabama and Mississippi. I mean, roughly, it just kind of creeps away. But the weird branch, if you look at the map on the book, is the slash across Canada. There's this wild system of canals and waterways, right? So some of the trip, like about 2 days of that trip, we were on these massively commercial waterways, and there might have been a container ship that was many, many tons right next to us, right? And we have some pictures taken right out of the window of these big container boats. And we actually used the same locks that they did, and they would kind of throw these ropes down from way high on the wall, and you know, we were kind of getting blown off the wall, and you know, kind of some embarrassing stories were told in that book, because you know, we're not big boating people. But then there are also these hand operated locks, right, that are a lot like the Erie Canal, where the Erie Canal is operated mostly by engineers. Well, in Canada, these are operated by Parks and Rec people that are trained in hospitality, and then they're taught to do the canal work, right? And so we had a tremendous time cutting across the Canadian system with these canals. And then there's this place called Georgian Bay in what's called the Small Ship Channel, where you have some of the most rugged and beautiful terrain in all the world, right? So if you were to Google for the most beautiful cruising waters, one of the things that would come up would be Georgian Bay. And we spent a good like 2 or 3 weeks there.
Are you only on the boat? Do you ever fly a plane or no? Because I feel like most tech guys, when they start to get towards, you know, towards some time in the career, they tend to be flying. Do you ever fly a plane or no?
Never have. And there's a reason for that. You know, I'd consider getting my pilot's license, but I am not a checklist kind of person. And if you want to fly, you really, really have to be. And, you know, that's the same reason I don't climb, right? Is my brain doesn't click that way. So you know, I do a little bit of gym climbing, but I don't do like outdoor high rock climbing because I forget little things, right? And you know, you can't be a pilot and do that. And actually in Miami, there was a man that said, Bruce, get a mission, you got to get a boat, like currently here. If you change the mission, you got to change the boat. And so we heard that and we thought about that and we sold our boat after the loop. And then someday we're kind of looking around and someday we'll get another boat that is more tuned for just cruising on the Tennessee River, right? We don't need something that's made to do a great loop anymore. We need something that's just for, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I haven't checked out this book yet, but I have bought it. It's on my list of books to read. It's really cool. Alan, do you have anything else you want to cover?
Oh, I mean, there's always tons of stuff I can ask Bruce, but there does have to be an end to this one. I mean, nothing's really sticking out at the moment. Just I've been pretty happy with the material that he's been putting out. And you do kind of do these books with other people, which is great, right? You don't have a typical writing partner, which is good, but you do have your name on a lot of things. So maybe that's your strategy. It's kind of attaching your name to many things so you show up a little bit higher than James in the search when you're competing with him. Is that right?
Oh, I'm not trying to compete with anybody. I just it's a human thing, right? It's all about people.
I guess I can kind of more so end my last question with this. Is, you know, I think you said you just went to Code Beam. Where's your next kind of public outing? I don't know what you call that. The next place you're coming out in public, next kind of conference or something like that you have planned?
I am not traveling for the rest of the year. I'll be going to a small conference in Portugal next year, next April. And then we have Gig City Elixir in May. That's it.
All right. That was pretty easy. I thought you'd have a much more aggressive schedule, but yeah, nothing else on my side.
Bruce, did we cover everything they want to cover? Is there anything else that would you like to kind of pitch before you go to the picks?
That's it for me. So thank you so much for inviting me on. I've enjoyed this tremendously. Can't believe it's been so long.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy. So I guess I'm going to transition us to picks. Alan, do you want to go first? Do you have any picks today?
Wow, I didn't even think about a pick. It's been so long. I guess the only thing I can pick is I've been still playing around with this Ash framework, and I still think it's a great thing. You know, Bruce mentioned about Flop. We used to use a lot of Flop, but Ash actually does add a Flop-like thing to it. So I find myself adding less and less plugins nowadays. So if people haven't tried it out, I highly recommend just play around with it.
Nice. Yeah, I hadn't heard of Flop until now, actually. Really cool. I feel there's been a lot of frameworks that do things in this direction, filtering, sorting, pagination, and yeah, Ash is a good call out. I'm yet to convince a company to use it, but I have used it, and Alan since he recommended it. It's really cool. I guess a pick from me, I forgot who goes first, the host, so I guess I'll just go before. I guess I have these headphones that I'm wearing right now. They're pretty interesting. So the company's Shox, and the model is Open Run. So they're like they don't go inside your ears, right? I'm not a fan of them, but they're also not like headphones. Like they don't block your ears. You just put them on the side of your ear and it transmits sound through bone transmission. It's safe. I Googled, researched this, but it's pretty interesting. I did not know this existed. It's really cool because you can listen to, you know, what you're listening, but still be aware of your surroundings. So I was always like a little nervous about that. So yeah, check these out. Shox, Open Run. I'll link it in the notes of the show. Yeah, that's it for my pick today. Bruce, do you have any picks for us?
Yeah, I'm going to go with our Groxio 40% off. It's a Black Friday sale. We do this once a year, and it's going to be all November. And so come on. Yeah, we have a interesting way of teaching.
Great. Well, I think that's it for today then. Thanks so much, Bruce, for coming. It was great chatting with you after a while. And yeah, we'll see all the listeners probably next week. Hopefully, we don't have any guests scheduled, but we haven't been recording as often as we used to. But yeah, we'll probably see you guys soon. Thanks, everyone.
Take care.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply. People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Terms and conditions apply.